so forth, of his day. After Augustine, we move into the medieval period. This is Roman numeral 15. Medieval philosophy is characterized, and medieval culture is characterized by syntheses. That's the third of the three terms that you see in that outline. Paganism, antithesis, then synthesis. And the reason I say this is a period of synthesis is that rather than setting Christianity purely and self-consciously over against the thinking of the world, in many of these medieval thinkers, there's an attempt to blend the world and the church, to synthesize the two. Rather than stressing antithesis, there's an attempt to have both the world and the church, if you will. Well, we see it culturally, in that in the Middle Ages, church and state were not separated. There was a blending of church and state. We see it in the intellectual world because natural reason was thought to have its own place and its own sufficiency, and then supernatural faith given to us in the Scriptures and by the Holy Spirit supplements what man's natural reason can do. So instead of pitting man's autonomy, his natural way of thinking, over against those who were informed by supernatural revelation, in the Middle Ages there's an attempt to have both, to bring them together. And there's also a soteriological kind of synthesis that develops in the Middle Ages, where salvation, in its pristine purity, the New Testament preaches salvation is by the grace of God. But in the Middle Ages, man's works come to be syncretized with the grace of God. So you have God does something, man does something, and they work together to get salvation accomplished. So whether you look culturally at church and state, or intellectually at reason and faith, or soteriologically at grace and works, the Middle Ages is characterized by what? An attempt to synthesize, bring things together, rather than to draw clear distinctions and see the antithesis. The two recurring problems in the philosophy of the Middle Ages, first of all, the relationship of faith to reason. Can man's reason prove the existence of God, or is that known only by faith? What's the relationship between faith and reason? And then the second problem is, what is the nature of universals? When we talked about Plato a few moments ago, I said Plato believed in something called duckness. Well, the medievals believed that there were concepts or universals like duckness and triangularity and justice. But the question was, do these things exist separately? Or, that's the realist answer, universals are real, they have separate existence, separate from the three ducks out on the pond. Or another answer is, no, universals are just a way of speaking. That's nominalism. Universals are just a name. We see a similarity in these three things on the pond, and we give it the name duck. So universal is just a word. And then another view, popularized by Abelard, is that universals are concepts in the mind, that they don't exist apart from the ducks, but the mind abstracts duckness when it looks at the ducks. It's not just a word, but it's something that comes about through this mental process of abstraction. And so these are the two recurring problems in the Middle Ages, faith and reason, one, and two, the problem of universals. In the first period of the Middle Ages, we looked at philosophers like Boethius and Erigena, Avicenna, Anselm, Rosellinus. Abelard, who believed that reason should dominate our Christian thinking, Bernard, who thought that piety should dominate our Christian thinking, and Averroes, who believed that there is a separation between faith and reason. There are two different kinds of truth that don't have anything to do with each other. Roman numeral 16, now you know that we begin this course with 17, so that means we're getting close. Roman numeral 16 in our last course was Aquinas and after. Thomas Aquinas is the great systematic thinker of the Middle Ages. He stands on a par with Augustine in the patristic or Roman period. Aquinas and Augustine, however, did not see things the same way. Where Augustine was more Platonic in his approach to things, Aquinas was Aristotelian in his approach to things. He thought that you could prove God's existence by natural reason and essentially took Aristotle and baptized him with Christian terminology and so forth. The philosophers following Aquinas, or at the same time of Aquinas, were Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, William of Ockham, Nicholas of Cusa. And I would like to look at these philosophers with a little more detail as we come to the end of this first part of your outline on the Middle Ages, because in looking at these philosophers, we begin to see the seeds of the Renaissance. Not the Renaissance, but we begin at the end of the Middle Ages to see the developments that will bring about the Renaissance. All right, let's move to D on your outline, which is really the end of the Middle Ages, end of the medieval period. I'd like to do a little more commentary on specific philosophers here, because I believe we see the beginnings of the Renaissance, or what I'll call seeds of the Renaissance, at the end of the Middle Ages. And I'm going to say this only once, both for the sake of those who are listening by tape and for those of you in the course. As I'm going through my lectures, I am depending not at all entirely on one text, because I have my own comments and all sorts of other reading that get incorporated. But if there's any one source that needs to be credited so that you know what I'm depending on, it's W.T. Jones, The History of Philosophy. I believe it's now published in 5 volumes. Okay, so much of what I'm saying and what organizes the material is Jones. Just so credit is given where credit is due, or discredit where discredit is due. Please be aware of that. Okay, the end of the Middle Ages. The whirlwind tour that I've given you of ancient and medieval philosophy has not sufficiently savored and appreciated the accomplishment of Thomas Aquinas. That's one, because we went over it so quickly, and two, because I don't happen to agree with the Thomistic approach to philosophy. Nevertheless, even though I don't follow Aquinas, I have a great respect for what he accomplished. And the cultural implications and consequences of what Thomas did must be understood if you're going to see how the Renaissance begins to develop after Aquinas. Okay? What is it that was so great about Aquinas' philosophy in terms of its grandeur and its cultural effect? Again, I don't agree with what he said. That isn't the approach I take. But what Thomas did is, he was able to bring together faith and reason, he thought. Natural reason has its domain, has its competence, and men should use it to understand this world in which we live, and to understand certain basic philosophical truths, including the existence of God. So Thomas thought that if men would be rational, they would have to agree that a God that is infinite and morally good and provident toward this world exists. So he did not think that religion was wholly otherworldly and mystical. He did believe that you could use your mind and know God. And those who use their minds the best would know God. He also believed that there was a place for supernatural revelation, Because though reason can show you that there is a God who is infinite and perfect, eternal and perfect, that he's intelligent and provident, nevertheless, reason cannot tell you a number of things about the nature of God, for instance, that he's triune, and reason cannot in itself show you many of the attributes of God, particularly his saving grace. And so Aquinas had a place for man's natural pursuit of knowledge of the world to use his reason, but he also had a place for supernatural revelation. And I don't agree with the way he did it, but you can understand that that's a great accomplishment, a significant program, if nothing else, to be able to bring both of these together. And in so doing, Aquinas proposed a systematic, unified worldview so that everything in man's experience, whether it be secular or sacred, had its place and had its explanation. All of life was unified in his approach. There was a worldview that brought together every domain of study and every aspect of man's experience, individual and social, rational and emotional, technological and ethical. Everything had its place. Everything had its order. Everything had its purpose. Now, of course, one of the things I would complain about is that in doing this, Aquinas essentially baptized Aristotle. Aristotle is the one who had a place for everything in terms of his teleological approach to the world and so forth, and Aristotle had his God, if you will, the thought thinking itself and so forth, the unmover. And in that sense, I think that the philosophy of Aquinas is really too shallow and too cheap to be Christian philosophy, because it's just Aristotle kind of dressed up with Christian terminology. That's an overstatement, and I apologize to the memory of Aquinas and to those who still think highly of him, but the overstatement is to make a point. He essentially had a unified worldview that he took from a pagan and then added Christian elements to it, and kind of, you know, made it acceptable to the church. Well, but it was so grand, it was so systematic, that it did capture the minds of people, and it did become the official dogma of the church. Because Aquinas had a worldview which allowed a place for every department of human learning that was unified with all the other departments of human learning, had a place for man in his natural as well as his supernatural environment. The university of the Middle Ages was possible. Now that may sound funny to you, because you'll say, well, we have universities today, Dr. Bonson. Well, as a matter of fact, we don't have universities today. We have things that are called universities today, but they are not universities. Now, I'm not getting in some kind of dig against schools that I don't like, saying, oh, they're not really universities, you know. They can't beat USC in football, so they don't deserve the name university or something. No, but the concept of the university, think about it. The word itself tells you what's going on here. You have diversity. Okay, there's psychology, biology, physics, art, music, whatever it may be. You have diversity, but that diversity has, if you will, behind it, a cohesion, a rationale, or a unity. There's a place for every department of life and form of human inquiry, because there's first of all a vision of the world that's organized, a vision that has a place because God has created it for all these things that we're doing, has a place for man's desire, his salvation, his ethics, and so forth. There is a unity then that informs the diversity. So the university, the unity with diversity, was possible in the Middle Ages, especially with the ascendancy of the thought of Thomas Aquinas. There was an all-embracing worldview. In our day, though, everything is fragmented. Nothing's related to anything. And that's why I say we don't have universities today. You can't harmonize the thinking of the psych department and the poli-sci department at just about any university in our land today. They use different principles of interpretation and organization and explanation. You'll learn, this is just one example, in the psych department, you'll learn that men are basically white rats, you know, and they've been stimulated and conditioned in a certain way by their environment or a combination of environment and heredity and so forth. Okay, so there is no freedom. There's the illusion of freedom, but there's no genuine freedom. We are whatever our environment, our upbringing, and our conditioning makes us. But you go over to the poli-sci department, and you'll have people who are fomenting revolution, telling you, you know, men have got to be free, break the shackles, you know, break your chains, assert yourself, your human dignity, throw off these oppressive overlords, you know, learn your true self. Well, we stop and think about it. Is there a unity to this diversity? One says you're a white rat, you have no freedom, you're just whatever your stimulus condition mechanism has made you. And the other says you are free, you determine your destiny, you have dignity. White rat, dignity. You know, kind of like in the morning you learn that you're nothing but an animal, in the afternoon you learn that you're one of the free determiners of the history of mankind. Well, which is it? You can't have it both ways. That is just one blatant example of the fragmentation of modern culture and the modern alleged university. There is no uni to the versity anymore. There's just versity. So from now on, we're going to call secular institutions not universities, but just versities, okay? There's a lot of versity over there, but not a whole lot of unity. Yes, sir?
Could you not say, though, that the unity, that there is a unity, and that would be evolution, might make right, survival of the fittest?
There are common themes that come out of many of the departments of the university, but even those are not universally held. And it's more, you have to understand that what makes something a cohesive element for the diversity of the modern university must be more than just that many departments agree on certain outcomes, like that man is an evolutionary product or what have you. You see, many of the departments will tell you that evolution isn't possible because there is no order to development. If you hold to evolution, you might also go along with Hegel or Marx in terms of a dialectic of history and all that, and they don't want to hold to that. So there's so many different things. But even where they agree, to get back to my point, even where they agree, those ideas were not the, if you will, the systemic origin or the motivating force behind the study of all these diverse things. About the closest you can get, what you have had in our century, is Marxist universities. Because Marxism is a comprehensive worldview. It's not a good one. I don't agree with it. Don't anyone take it that I'm being soft on the commies here. But the fact of the matter is that Marxism as a philosophical system had a grandeur, a system, had a view of history, man's place, what's wrong with man, how to solve that problem, and so forth. You could have a Marxist university. It would be horrible. It would be in the service of the evil one, as far as I'm concerned. But nevertheless, it would have a unity that informs the diversity. Evolutionary thought, political positivism, the idea that might makes right, and so forth. That is not a root motive cohesion that informs the diversity of the modern university. Though it is held commonly in many of the departments, I agree. Okay, so Thomas Aquinas, he's Middle Ages. We've been talking about that. Thomas Aquinas, I don't agree with him, but he had a certain accomplishment that has to be respected. Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican monk. Okay? For those of you who don't know these differences, it is important that you go back and get a little elementary introduction to medieval thought. There are different orders, different types of monasteries that developed in the early church and through the Middle Ages. One order of monks, Dominican, emphasized reason and intellect, and another major order of monasteries, known as Franciscan monasteries, tended to emphasize more piety and, if you will, an Augustinian approach to Christianity. That doesn't mean they were all good Augustinians. It just means that in terms of emphases, the Franciscans were more Augustinian in their outlook. There are three Franciscan scholars that one must understand to see the dissolution of the Middle Ages and the grand synthesis of the Dominican Aquinas. Thomas had his systematic worldview. You know, faith perfects reason, and there's a place for everything. Essentially, he's Aristotelian. Though he's interested in the particulars of this world, he approaches these particulars philosophically with a view to the form and matter that accounts for them and their telos or aim or purpose. Everything is moving toward its proper end. Everything has its place. Everything works together harmoniously in the whole of this faith-reason scheme. Roger Bacon, the Franciscan scholar at the end of the Middle Ages, who begins to show differences with Aquinas and the seeds of the Renaissance. I'm beginning just a brief and basic timeline on the board so that you can see some relationships here. Roger Bacon is a contemporary of Aquinas. In fact, he's really a little bit younger, a little bit older, than Aquinas, because Bacon was born probably 1214, thereabout, Aquinas 1225. And Aquinas died in 1274, and Bacon still lived about 20 years beyond that. So here he is, the contemporary of Thomas Aquinas. He is an English scholar who studied at Oxford and eventually taught at the University of Paris. Bacon was an expert in ancient languages. Greek was not emphasized, was not well known in the Western world at this time at all, and he mastered Greek as well as Hebrew and Arabic and Chaldean. And by the way, Bacon tells us explicitly that the reason he mastered the ancient languages is so that he'd understand the text of the Bible more exactly and purely. Already the seeds of the Renaissance are seen, because by the time we get to the Renaissance, the emphasis is upon the study of ancient texts. And Roger Bacon was somebody who could appreciate that. In fact, he was a publicist, if you will, for the ability to read the ancient texts and to understand them properly, not just to accept the tradition of what one scholar says, another scholar said, and so forth. In addition to his emphasis upon textual study, which had a Christian motivation, remember, he put great emphasis on the importance of looking at the natural world. He was curious about this world in which he lived. He wanted to know more about it. He wanted to understand math and physics, and particularly Bacon looked at the practical importance of what we would call science. That is to say, he was concerned for the utility of knowledge. To say that knowledge has a utility is to say it has a usefulness. It isn't just some kind of irrelevant, vague speculation about something that doesn't touch on the details of life. But knowledge is useful. Bacon emphasized the superiority of observation or personal direct experience instead of listening to what others had to say or the authority of tradition. Now, I know this is not going to sound earth-shaking to most of you because we take almost all of that for granted ourselves. But in the Middle Ages, it was assumed that scholarship meant listening to the authority of others. You don't have to go back to the originals and study it yourself. So you don't have to know Greek and Hebrew, for instance. The monks have to, so they can copy the manuscripts. But scholars don't necessarily have to do that. They know Latin. They know the language of intellectual exchange. But beyond that, they wouldn't have to. And taking an interest in the natural world, emphasizing personal experience, was an anticipation of what we come to call the scientific method. Notice, however, that in this budding interest in a more empirical, experiential approach to the world, that Roger Bacon did not give up his conviction about the truth of God's Word and the Scriptures, nor did he get rid of the superiority of theology as the organizing unity for all of the sciences. So he was not a Renaissance man. Because one of the things that will characterize the Renaissance is that we don't have to have God's authority at the center of our worldview. Man's authority and man's dignity will take its place. So that's why we still put him at the end of the Middle Ages. But this budding interest in textual study and in personal experience of the natural world over against tradition will prove to be the spirit of the Renaissance. In the year 1266, the Pope called upon Bacon to prepare a treatise that would set out a universal science. Universal, okay? So there's that grandiose scope of scholastic, you know, scholarship. Like Aquinas, who was his contemporary, he wanted to organize everything that man could know into a unity. Everything would have its place. And so Bacon's learning was encyclopedic. He knew a lot. In comparison to his contemporaries, he knew a lot about many different fields. But the central theme of the work that he wrote, by the way, the Pope died, the Pope that commissioned it died before it was finished, and a subsequent Pope didn't have a great interest in it, and so Bacon was really kind of left hanging there. But he finished the work, Opus Majus, and its central theme is the utility of knowledge. The reason why we ought to learn about the world is because it's so practical. And ultimately, because he was a Christian, Bacon said, the greatest practicality of learning about the world, the greatest utility of science, is that it perfects our knowledge of God and enables the church to do its service. So all I'm saying here is that we have in Bacon the beginning of an interest in the empirical approach to the world. Empirical means observational, over against rational, over against stressing the coherence of experience and what must be true logically and so forth. He said, we have to go out and see. We need to experience and observe. We're going to know the world as God has made it.